Hi, I'm Rob Nesbitt, and this is the ProCartoon.com podcast. I look at the tools of the trade, tips, tricks, podcast reviews and interviews, and more to help you in your cartooning and artistic work. In this episode of the Pro Cartoon podcast, I interview Todd Showalter from St. Louis in Missouri, a professional cartoonist, animator and film producer who has many more talents besides. Todd talks about his brand new development he's currently working on called Toon Screen, which allows cartoonists and cartoon animators to display their work globally and receive payment. It's a great idea that cuts out the middleman and the gatekeepers that stand in the way of getting your cartoon artwork published. Since 1989, Todd Showalter has had his cartoon work distributed nationally. His work has appeared internationally, featured on television, advertisements, books, magazines and greeting cards. When Hanna-Barbera optioned one of Todd's cartoon strips, Danny's Dream Machine, he expanded his cartoon business into the world of animation. He now has an impressive catalogue of animated shorts which include Ghost Dog, the comic strip, Manamoose, Mafia Mom, which is my particular favourite with a brilliant tagline. The tagline is, "The Godfather of Grandmothers." I love it, as it reminds me of my mother-in-law. Dave and Jen, Mystic Planet, Leo and the Legend, and Interpets. I also give a personal update and answer more of your questions. I really appreciate your questions, so keep them coming. It keeps me on my toes. You can see the show notes and the transcription of the podcast at ProCartoon.com on the podcast page. Okay, let's dive straight into the podcast. Hi everyone, I'm going to start with a personal update. We're still in a partial pandemic lockdown over here in the UK, but it's been a great time in one respect to be creative. I've done a lot of cartoon work over the lockdown, anticipating future events such as Christmas, which is only 5 months away. I've also been writing a series of sci-fi novels and have just finished the second in a trilogy. Although not related to cartooning, the process of publishing my own novels for the Amazon KDP market has an artistic side. I looked at the price of getting covers produced by professional cover designers and shuddered. Hundreds of bucks per cover, and I need quite a few. So I did what every professional book publishing pundit says not to do, and have started designing the covers myself. Take a look in the podcast show notes where I've put some together of my first draft cover designs and see what you think. It's been an interesting challenge using Photoshop to create them. I'm still putting together my brass band cartoon book, which will either be printed or put on Amazon's print-on-demand service ready for the Christmas market. This has been a nostalgic trip looking at the cartoons I've drawn and articles written for Brass Band World magazine over the last 18 years. Putting the best of them into one book has been quite interesting as I look at what I've done in the past, spotting mistakes. However closely you look, particularly if you do detailed cartoons, you can miss stuff. A few pixels missing here, an overlapping line there, that sort of thing. I used to get really annoyed with myself, but have now learned to live with these little niggles. I can also see how I have advanced over the years, particularly with graphic software. Moving on, here's a couple of your questions which I always enjoy receiving as it keeps my cogs turning. Please keep sending them in through the contact page. The first question is from Jeff Allen from Utah in the US. I use watercolours in my cartoons but could never seem to get bright colours. I'm not technically minded and don't like using a graphics tablet. Are there watercolour paints that provide more vibrant colours? That's a great question, Jeff. Getting watercolours to pop off the page can be difficult. As the name suggests, they're pigments that can be diluted with water and mainly used by artists for an incredible effects they can get with them, such as clouds, skies and water. Sometimes increasing the pigment to water ratio destroys that effect. If you're looking for a flatter, brighter colour, it might be worth trying acrylics instead, which can be layered to give a really vibrant colour. If you want to maintain the watercolour feel, I suggest you paint in watercolour, then add chalk pastel over the top with some water for the areas you want to pop off the page. A picture paints 1,000 words, and there is an example in the show notes of a painting by Welsh artist Dorian Spencer Davis, who uses this process to create superb semi-cartoon style watercolours of Welsh towns and seaside resorts. I asked him how he manages to get such vibrant colours, expecting him to say that he uses some mega expensive paint, but no, it's just a box of chalk pastels mixed with water. Try it. I did, and it works really well. You can either apply them dry, then add a wet brush, or apply wet chalk pastel pigment on the brush. I suggest you try both. The next question is from Caroline Jones, from just down the road from me in Cardiff, sunny South Wales in the UK. I have a clerical day job and want to start selling my cartoon artwork as a sideline. What is the best way to get my work noticed when I have very little spare cash to advertise? I think every one of us has been in that position. I don't like spending bucket loads of cash, but then again, that's the miser in me, I suppose. We're in the best time ever for artists to get their artwork out there globally, and it doesn't have to break the bank. You can create a Facebook business page for free. I have several for the various businesses and projects that I run. You can display your work, invite all your Facebook friends to like your page, and start getting yourself and your cartoons known. For not a lot of money, you can advertise on Facebook. I used it on my Nezzy on Brass Facebook page to build a community of followers in the brass banding world, which is my other hobby. I gained an extra 1,000+ likes for the page in just a couple of months, and these are all potential customers. You can also create a shop in Facebook, and it's all free. Cartoon work also suits Instagram, which is fast becoming a huge platform for artists. I've only just ventured into this myself, as my wife loves gardening and takes photos of flowers that she grows. She now has 1,500 followers, or flowerers as she calls them, and that has only taken around 5 months. Twitter isn't something I would recommend for advertising, as they've not had decent results, but there again, others may disagree. I would also look at getting your own website with a shop, or you could use a third party such as Etsy, where you can create a shop and they take a small cut for advertising and sales. As I said, it's never been a better time to get your work out there. I've written an extensive article on where to sell your artwork. You can find the link in the show notes. Okay, I now move on to the main feature of this podcast, an interview with Todd Schwalter. Todd is a multi-talented cartoonist, animator, actor, producer, and stand-up comedian who runs his own company, Todd Schwalter Productions. His cartoon work has been distributed nationally, and his cartoons and animation work has been seen globally through television, books, adverts, and a host of other media. Todd, originally from Texas, now lives in St. Louis, Missouri, with his family. Hi, Todd, and welcome to the Pro Cartoon Podcast. It's great to have you on the show.
Thanks, Rob. It's great to be here.
When did your cartoon career begin, and what was the influence that made you start drawing cartoons?
Well, you know, I was one of those kids that was, I've been drawing my entire life. The, you know, running family jokes, I used to draw on the furniture with my mom's lipstick. So I guess I've been drawing since I was born, so to speak. But, you know, I drew through school, you know, through school and up until I was 14, I hadn't, you know, made a dime for it. But when I was 14, I actually got a job as the editorial cartoonist for an African-American paper in St. Louis, Missouri, which was really, you know, quite the experience. I used to go to work with my father down into the city every once in a while. And I would, it was back in the day when things were, you know, a little bit safer, and he'd let me ride the bus. One day, I mean, I took my mini kit portfolio, just dropped in on this paper called the St. Louis Sentinel. They were gracious enough to meet with me. And I guess they liked what they saw for a 14-year-old. I mean, if I look back at it now, I mean, I don't know. I don't know if they needed contacts or eyeglasses or what, but no, they took me on, and I ended up working with them for a couple of years, and it was quite the experience because, again, they were an African-American paper, and I was Caucasian, white, 14-year-old, and it was eye-opening. But, yeah, that was my first paycheck as a cartoonist, so to speak, and it just luckily went on from there.
That's a very young start. I've never heard of that before. Not that young, anyway.
Well, you know, at that point, you know, you hadn't, you know, become accustomed to a lot of rejection, and so you know, that comes with the game too. But, you know, yeah, I think that's important regardless of your 14-year-old kid or whether you're 44 or anything. I mean, you've got to put yourself out there because if you don't get in the game, you're not going to play. And it's really important regardless of what age you're at. But yeah, I mean, I was naive. I was a kid, you know, and but, you know, they were nice enough and gracious enough to take a chance on me. And it was a great experience. And that was pretty much the beginning of my career, so to speak. But I've been drawing my whole life.
That's a great Kickstarter for anybody, isn't it, in the cartooning industry? Are there any other artists in your family?
Well, my mom, she's retired, but she was an interior designer. My grandfather, he was a very good draftsman. He was going to go to architectural school, but that was back in, you know, the 30s and whatnot, and he ended up having to support the family. So there aren't any cartoonists, professional ones, in the family, but I guess the closest would be my mom, who's she's always been very artistic, but she did it in a different medium, you know, interior design.
So I could, it could be
a family of lawyers, believe it or not. Yeah, that's where I get my sense of humor.
Are you a full-time cartoonist?
Yes. Yes, I am. I'm a cartoonist, animator, and a film producer. So I juggle them all, and people wonder what the heck I'm doing at any moment of the day.
Your resume is diverse. As you've just said, you're a cartoonist, actor, producer, stand-up comedian, and much more. That's a lot to pack into one career. Taking a couple of these diverse skills, stand-up comedian and actor-producer, I wondered how you came across doing this and how you developed the skills to do it.
Well, I mean, they may be diverse in, you know, a lot of different roles, so to speak, but, you know, they all kind of tie together. I mean, acting and producing ties very nicely into cartooning. I mean, cartooning, you're basically setting your stage, you're writing your script, you have your characters, which you're creating. And it's really very similar to a play or a film or anything else, because rather than using the medium of film, you're using the medium of, you know, either the palette or your paper or even your screen. So a lot of them go hand in hand. It's not like I'm doing an oil change one day and flying an airliner the next and doing heart surgery the next. I mean, they all kind of, they're intercombined. And I don't like being tied, you know, to one single thing, because I tend to get bored. I like juggling and multitasking and working on a lot of projects, because I think it really helps you creatively. I think if you get stuck in a rut in one area, you can shift gears and start, you know, working on something else that you've got going. And by doing that, taking that break, you put your creativity into something different, but it also rejuvenates you when you go back to what you were all working on earlier. So it's really not that far-fetched, and it's really not that hard to do. I enjoy it, and it keeps me fresh.
The only thing I find is that sometimes you get too creative and you get frustrated because you want to do different things at once, or you get sidetracked. I don't know if that's the same for you.
Well, yeah, I mean, but that's okay. I mean, you don't have to do it all at once. I mean, there are different things. I mean, I take elements out of each day and that, you know, may apply to something else. I'll tell you a quick story about a film that we're producing right now. I read a story in the paper a couple of weeks ago that just struck me as funny. It was about a camp. I mean, not that the subject matter is not funny, but it's about a homeless camp where the leader kind of loses it, and they have to protect themselves from this guy and find a new leader. And this was a real story in the paper. And so I said, well, this will make a film. And I started working on that script. Now, earlier in the morning, I had no intention of doing that, okay? But that's what I'm saying. You shift. And at the same time that I'm working on my cartoons, the ideas for gags and storylines and things like that, they come throughout the day. They come throughout the week. It's not like I give myself a certain minute or block in the clock, so to speak, to actually do my work. That stuff is coming all the time. And I think by keeping your mind open to a lot of different things, you experience more. And anything, regardless of what it is, can be applied to one of those mediums creatively. And so that's what I enjoy about it.
Yeah, I think as a cartoonist, where you can see things that a lot of people can't.
And
see the funny angle on it.
Well, that's just it. You're just taking observations, looking at them slightly differently, and taking something that everybody is aware of and knows about and bringing out the funny aspect of it. So, yeah, definitely.
Here's a shout out to all cartoonists who would like some free advertising for their products or services. If you're a cartoonist and would like to advertise your services, I'm setting up a section on procartoon.com for cartoonists and other artists to showcase their talents. The first 10 that apply will get free ad placement. To apply, simply contact me, Rob Nesbitt, via the contact page on procartoon.com. Send me an outline of what you do, what you have to offer, plus contact details, and I will send out the format to submit your free ad space, which will be a page to yourself plus images of your work, contact details, etc. Your cartoons have a very high quality commercial feel. How do you produce them? Is it on a graphics package, or do you hand draw, or is it a combination of both?
Right. Well, what I do right now, I am going to experiment with a Cintiq down the line. What I've done forever, including to this day, I still use the pencil, regular paper. I start out with a sketch. And so it goes right from my hand onto the paper. I like the organic feel of that. Typically, what I do after that is, I'll take care of the lettering or do the inking, whether it's on Bristol board with a dip pen, C5, whatnot, Speedball, or I use a lot of Micron pens also. And so I'll actually do it by hand because you kind of get that natural feel. I don't like a real kind of, manufactured look. But, also with that, I'll take the hand drawings, the hand inkings, I'll scan them. And typically, from there, I'll work in Photoshop for, any color work or change them into the formats I need to actually be published or go online. So it's kind of a combination, but the beginning still always comes from the pen and paper.
Yeah, I thought when I first bought a graphics tablet, I could wave goodbye to all the pencils, but no.
Right.
Same thing. I just love the feel of a pencil in my hand on the surface of paper. There's something magical about it that I can't let go.
Well, and it has an organic feel. I mean, when I try to explain it to some people, and nothing against the Cintiq. I think the drawing tabs, I wasn't trying to promote them in particular. I'm just saying that's what I'm looking at. But I'll be interested to see how it works. But it's kind of like if you have albums like 33, or records, 45s, as opposed to CDs. I mean, CDs, you've got that crisp, clear sound. But with, records and, albums and things like that, you kind of get that gritty poppiness and things like that. It kind of gives it a, like I said, an organic feel to it. And I just think you accomplish that more with a pen and paper. Or bristle board, whatever you're using, then you can just digitally, because I think it has its limitations where, pen and paper, you can do anything and scan it and there you go.
As a cartoonist, who are your biggest influences?
Well, I mean, growing up, I like a lot of people. I mean, Charles Schulz, which I have a funny story about him. I get to meet him later on down the road. He was always a big influence, whether it be, the characters, the specials on television, or even the strip. As I moved along, Berkeley Breathitt, I liked him a lot as I moved into my college years, and I was fortunate enough to get in touch with him as well. And so, I followed him. I liked his humor, and, he came when Doonesbury was on hiatus. I think he took his strip to another level. So I always admired him a lot. Obviously, Bill Watterson with Calvin and Hobbes. I mean, it's one of the classics. I mean, that's like, the other, the top of the top, in my opinion. Gary Larson, I mean, probably the best gag writer, panel cartoonist that is still out there. And he's coming back, by the way. So, but there were a variety. I can't really say that there was one cartoonist, I really wanted to, be like, because I like different cartoonists for different reasons. I liked certain cartoonists' writing style, where I liked other cartoonists' artwork. So it wasn't, I would admire them, for different reasons rather than just as a cartoonist as a whole. And fortunately, I've gotten to meet a lot of them through the National Cartoonist Society. So that, that's been a big thrill. I was at the Rubin Awards one year. We were in San Francisco. And like I said, I've followed Charles Schulz my entire life. And I don't know, it's the luck of our name. My last name is S-C-H-O. He's S-C-H-U. I don't know why we're all in close proximity as we were. But he and I ended up sitting together on the transport bus taking us to a hospital to draw pictures for the kids in the hospital. It was really wild because, you grow up idolizing somebody and they're sitting right next to you. And but he was gracious and he was a great guy. And his wife, Jean, was very nice also. And that was one of the highlights of my cartooning career, is just talking with him.
Going back to one that you said, Larson, Gary Larson.
Gary Larson, yeah.
I absolutely love this stuff because it just cracks me up. A lot of the stuff is just visual, and I just I think that's probably the most difficult to do is a visual rather than with, the gag going with it.
Oh, absolutely. And he's coming back, by the way. He'll be with, I don't know if he's coming out with UClick. Andrews McMeal, he's with them still, I believe. But I read a funny story about Gary. you know, he apparently his studio, his drawing board overlooks a beautiful up in the northwest of the United States. He's got a beautiful view of whatever they have in the Northwest mountains and whatnot. Apparently, though, even with that beautiful view, he doesn't see it because he draws his cartoons at night when it's pitch black, because that's when he actually does his cartoons. So it doesn't matter. He could be looking at a blank wall. So I found that rather ironic. He's got this great view, but that's not what he looks at. So he's looking at the dark when he draws his comics.
What is your process when you get a client that commissions you? How do you tackle that?
Well, I mean, typically what I do is it depends on what the client wants and what the job is. A lot of times it'll either be to develop a strip or develop a custom cartoon for something that they're doing. I'm working right now on developing a whole cast of characters that are going to represent a product line. And I like them to be part of the process. So I do it in stages. Typically I'll have an evaluation stage where they'll bring to the table, you know, what they expect, what kind of style they're thinking, you know, what kind of color, what they want, you know, this project to accomplish, because it's all about results in the end. And then I'll have a three-step process where I'll say, okay, we're going to come out with three different styles, not styles, I say to my own style, but three different directions. And which one of those directions do you feel strongest about? And typically, I'll tell you why, I mean, 80% of the time, they pick the direction that I hate, which is good, I guess, because you got to stay objective about it. But it's just like clockwork. I'll tell my wife, they're going to pick this one because I hate it. They pick that one. After we get past that stage, I'll do a whole nother series. And I'll say, okay, let's do two or three stages off of this series to see if we're getting closer. At that point, I pretty much have the project locked in so I can do final art and finish the project. But it's really important, I find, especially if you're dealing with committees, because everybody seems to want to, put their opinion in there just to justify their job or existence in the world. Good to get all that preliminary feedback and let everybody get their two cents in early before you put all the end work in. So I try to kind of coax them along. I usually have three stages, and each stage has about three series to it. And by the end, you know, they feel good about it because they had things to check off along the way. And I like it too, because I haven't wasted a lot of time going off in the wrong direction. I kind of know what they want, and I know what I can bring to the table. And there's a lot of babysitting involved, but it makes my job easier because I know what they're going for and I know what I can do to make it happen. So yeah. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, no, perfect sense, because there's nothing worse than producing something and they said, well, I didn't really mean I wanted that. You sound as if you're nailing it to the floor before, you know, the final draft. Have you ever had the client from hell, without naming names?
Have I had a client or which one? I mean, I've had, yeah. Yes, I've been doing this for 30 years, okay? And I could tell you, this could be a whole other podcast. I could tell you about all my... But you typically, and going back to the committee situation, that's almost inevitably, if there's a committee, if you're dealing with a bigger corporation or something like that, or a studio or something like that, that's what you're going to have to deal with. And typically, you'll have everybody on board, or almost everybody, but there'll be that one that's just got to rock the boat. Well, I don't think his nose is quite big enough. And, you know, and you don't know why. I mean, it'll be something just relatively out in left field, but, you know, you've got to do something to make the unhappy, you know, give the cartoon character a nose job, you know, is to make this person happy. But there's always that one. Can't really pinpoint a worst. I mean, I've had some that have, you know, spun their wheels a lot. You know, I mean, there's typically with committees, you're always going to deal with that one. But that said, we've always, in every situation, be able to come to a resolution on it. And typically, you know, you make the nose bigger, but not quite as big as everybody wanted. They're happy. Everybody else is happy. And, you know, so the better. But, you get that dealing in one-on-one situations, too. But the committees are the hardest for me.
Oh, that's great. What is your favorite medium for creating cartoons and why? Is it, like, I'm talking, you know, like pencil, paint, or anything else that you use during your process of creation?
I've kind of gone in different directions over the years. I was a big, dip guy. I used C5 Speedballs. And then I'd use, you know, the B models to do the lettering. And so I like the line fluctuation that, you know, the dip pens, you know, gave me on bristle board. I was a staff editorial cartoonist for two newspapers. And so everything I did with that was pen and ink as far as, you know, a dip pen. The Microns came along and the different, you know, weights and things of those pens. Those are just a lot easier. I mean, obviously, you know, if you're on the run and you're somewhere, I mean, you can't get out to your India ink and your dip pens and your boards and all that stuff. So if I'm in a rush, you know, I would use Microns, but then I kind of evolved more to that on a full-time basis. Ironically, I'm going back right now and going back to trying the old dip pens again. So I go back and forth. I mean, it's the only computer digital work I do at this point is still when it gets brought into Photoshop and just for coloring or for export in different formats, whether it's a JPEG, a PDF, whatnot. That's typically the way I work.
In the UK, we've the Cartoonist Club of Great Britain, which is open to published cartoonists in the UK. I think you've already touched on this, but what would be the equivalent in the USA and what qualifies you to become a member?
Well, that would be a National Cartoonist Society, the NCS. And they're not just the U.S. I mean, they're worldwide. Entry, you need to make the majority of your income from cartooning. That's going to be your main profession. I mean, you can be doing something else, but if that's what your main occupation is a cartoonist, then you're pretty much eligible. And, you know, they do review your work. You know, it's not like a fraternity hazing or anything like that. I don't know anybody that's met the, you know, being a full-time cartoonist or, you know, a majority of the time cartoonist ever be rejected because of their work. I mean, fortunately, we have a lot of good people, but that's pretty much it. And, you know, you pay your dues. They're broken up into different chapters regionally. I'm the vice chairman of the North Central chapter in the United States. So there are, I'd say, about 10 different regional chapters. But everybody gets together for the big annual Rubin Awards, which is kind of like the Academy Awards of cartooning. And it's typically at the end of May, and obviously it was postponed this year with, I don't even know if they're going to reschedule it because of everything going on. Yeah. But everybody comes together for that. There are different category awards. And so that's a good time. But the National Cartoonist Society would be the, you know, the equivalent, I guess, of what you're doing in the UK.
The UK one is simply published cartoonists, mm-hmm. but it's more to a profession in the US with the sound of it then. I understand you're currently busy developing products, including a new app. Could you tell us about your new innovations in the pipeline?
Yeah, well, I mentioned, I guess, before we started the podcast, I've got an app that I've been developing called TuneScreen. And what that is a new platform for cartoonists to hopefully monetize from and also be a new medium to actually get out there and promote cartoonist work. Right now, and not just right now, it's been going on for several years, a lot of cartoonists are in a flux and they don't really know what they're going to do because newspapers are going out of business. The comics pages are shrinking. One of the reasons Bill Watterson left is just because they were shrinking the strips so small. And so people are starting to kind of freak out a little bit. They don't know what's going to happen. I mean, there are different ways. You've got to be able to pivot and you've got to be able to transition into other mediums when that happens. It's the equivalent of when, you know, color was added to black and white movies or sound was added. I mean, you've got to go along with that evolution. And so with TuneScreen, it would be an app that would actually be a vehicle for comic strips and panels as well as animation. I mean, animated short series, things like that, where based on how much exposure each feature gets, that cartoonist would receive a part of, you know, whatever the profits were that TuneShare actually received. It's very early in development. I mean, what I'm trying to do now is just get feedback from a lot of creators, cartoonists, and also the public, you know, what they would like to see if something like this were to become available. That's what that is. I'm looking for different, you know, outlets for cartooning that, you know, might, you know, not only help, but expand, you know, where cartooning is going. And the neat thing about that is a lot of cartoonists don't think this way, but, you know, comic strips and even panels are created the way that they are because based on column lengths in newspapers. So you have your strip to fit the columns in a newspaper, you know, panels are the same way. And a visual screen like TuneScreen, you're not confined to columns anymore. You have the whole screen that you can work with. So, you know, back in the day with Terry and the Pirates and Milk Caniff, things like that, Steve Canyon, rather, you know, you had these brilliant cartoons, Sunday cartoons that, you know, just don't exist today. And I think by bringing them to a visual medium like this, where you have the full screen as a palette to work with, you know, that heyday may be yet to come. So that's the idea. Let's in development.
I think it's a great idea. I have had a look at Toon Screen, and I think that will really do well for you. I really do, because there's a lot of cartoonists, exactly as you said, they're scraping around trying to find a way to get their work out there. Mm-hmm. And this is a great way of doing it worldwide and making an affiliate fee out of their work. And I just think thumbs up to you. I think that's a brilliant concept that you've come up with.
I appreciate it. It is a labor of love, obviously, because I'm involved. But I mean, I see these other cartoonists that, you know, really any animators, they're just wondering, where the heck are we going? And this is an outlet. I think there's outlets that we haven't even experienced yet, but we're going to. And rather than get discouraged, I mean, I think this is a big changing time. I mean, I think if people get in on the ground level now, it could just be like when the strips came out in the papers back in the early, the beginning of the century, over 100 years ago. This is the time to get excited rather than discouraged.
Yeah, I was looking at it, and it struck me as being similar to trying to get your book published with a traditional publisher, which would be the newspaper.
Right.
And along come you, equivalent to like a Kindle. And, you know, you can...
Great example, yeah.
Most people can really have a go at this and get their work out there. I think it's great.
Right, and that's a great way of putting it, because that's what it is. You have the device right in your hand. I mean, it'll be available desktop too, but, you know, if you're anywhere, I mean, you can have your comics right there, your animated show right there in your hands. It's easy, and it's the cartoonist is benefiting from it. A lot of people don't like to hear this, but you're cutting out the middleman, because you're going direct to the readers and the viewers opposed to the middleman, which, whether it be the syndicates or our studios or whatnot. But yeah, I mean, that's the idea.
A difficult question for any cartoonist, but which piece of work would you rate as your absolute best?
I'll tell you the one that I've gotten the most mileage out of that was an accident. I mean, there are a lot of comics that I've really been excited about that, I've done over the 30-year span, actually longer than 30 years, whether, that I've liked for their editorial value, or I've liked for their comic strip value, or their humor. But I had this one character that I did almost as a joke. Our house here in St. Louis is on a corner lot, okay? And everybody walks their dogs. And, the dogs would all poop in our yard, okay? and this turned out to be a big problem with a lot of people, okay? So I drew who is now Buzz the dog. He's in a bunch of my work. I drew Buzz the dog. I put him on a sign, and I put it out in the yard. And, the sign got stolen, and I thought, okay. And so I put another one out. It got stolen, and I thought, and the other one's got stolen. My neighbor asked me about it. Can you draw me one? I go, well, I guess I could. And hers got stolen. And so the funny thing is, I thought, well, maybe there's something here. And just as a joke, I had some signs manufactured, and the signs went crazy. I mean, the poop free zone with Buzz the dog, the Buzz the dog character has now evolved into my logo. He's evolved. He's got his own comic. He's got his own. He's on T-shirts. He's on all kinds of stuff. So I wouldn't say it was my best work, but it was probably the strangest work with the most longevity to it. Having a dog poop in your yard turns into something I actually made some pretty good money off of. We had these poop signs were in bases in Afghanistan. They were like, they went worldwide. And they were all, and they're still available somewhere. I'm thinking of bringing them back. It was crazy. But Buzz the dog, who's still out there, that is probably the character that, again, if he's not my favorite, he was the most useful in many ways.
That's really made me laugh. That's great. If you had a time machine and you could go back to the early days when you first started drawing cartoons, what advice would you give the young Todd?
Well, don't color inside the lines. Okay, there's too many rules. I had teachers even as early as kindergarten. Now you got to color inside the lines. I don't want to color inside the lines. Well, you're never going to get an A if you don't color inside the line. You know, it was always something like that. So don't let any boundaries limit you. You may think that your style doesn't fit, or you think, you know, I've got to copy this person to be taken seriously. No. I mean, typically your style is already in you. You may have to perfect it. You may have to polish it a little bit, but everybody's got their own personal style. Like anybody, you know, back in the day, I mean, you know, you're making me see back in the day, I'm going way back in time. You know, there are certain cartoonists that I loved and I wanted to draw like them. And you know, that's neat, but nobody wants a copy when there's already the original. And everybody inside has their own original ability and their own talent. So when I say don't color inside the lines, do your own work, regardless of how you feel about it. And if you stick to it, you will develop over time your own look, your own style, and that's key. And then you're the original. So don't try to copy too many people. And you can take what's good with some people do. I mean, people steal from people all the time to an extent, but make sure that you stay to your true roots and do your own style.
Okay, so jump back into the time machine and go forward this time. So go forward 10 years from now. What would you like to have achieved in the next 10 years when you look back?
Well, what I'm doing right now is I'm putting together an animation studio. And so 10 years from now, I want to be producing a lot of content. I mean, content's key right now with all the different streaming channels and your handheld devices and everything. There are new platforms that are coming out every day. Unfortunately, content is in big demand right now. No, actually, it's not unfortunate. That's fortunate for guys like me and gals like you know, me that in the profession. So what I want to be doing with 10 years from now is not just producing content for the sake of being content, but have like putting out content that is in a variety of different areas, whether it's animation, print, books, which aren't going away. So in 10 years from now, I'd like to have my animation studio really thriving with a brand that is recognizable to a lot more people than it is right now, and you know, bringing entertainment and great content to a lot of people.
Where can listeners see your work and contact you? Where's the best place for them to find you?
Just feel free anytime to visit me online. My site is studiotodd.com, www.studiotodd.com. And you can visit me there, you know, contact me there. Tell me you hated me on this podcast there. Whatever you want to do, you can contact. You can see my work. You can watch my demo reel. You can get back to me, and I'll get back to you as soon as possible as well. So studiotodd.com, not Todd Studio, Studio Todd. That's the best bet.
Yeah, I'll make sure that all the links are in the show notes so that the listeners can find you easily. Well, Todd, thank you very much for an intriguing and very entertaining and enlightening podcast, because I think you've got some really good things on the go, and you're developing things for the cartoonists that I think will be amazing in the future. So thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
It's been a pleasure with me as well, and I appreciate you having me on your podcast. Thank you, Rob.
Before I go, are you a cartoonist or a supplier of artist materials? Perhaps you supply art-related technology or have an art-based business. I am looking for people to share their cartoony world with others on the podcast. If you're interested in being featured, please contact me through the link in the show notes. Okay, that's it for this edition of the podcast. Hope you enjoyed it, and catch you on the next one.